Thank you. Please be seated. All right, we're here for oral argument in our case number CV25-0774, Quigley versus Arriaga. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if desired. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs and conferenced the case this afternoon. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chris Lavoie for appellants. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. May it please the court. I would like to make four overarching points right out of the gate. The first is that the trial court applied the wrong legal standard. The second is that this is a fair value fee agreement, yet CDQ nowhere below addressed fair value, let alone presented any evidence regarding fair value. Three, CDQ never disclosed Albrecht Krogan as an expert witness. That is undisputed. Four, summary judgment was granted based on bills and time entries that were not in evidence, which was a basic foundational failure on CDQ's part. Below. Starting with the wrong legal standard, CDQ tacitly concedes this. Its only argument is invited error. Invited error concedes error. It's the starting point. It was CDQ who invited error by arguing China doll burden shifting in its briefing below. Appellants argued the exact opposite. They argued that the China doll burden shifting framework was not transferable from fee shifting to a lawyer-client dispute where fees are sought as damages, especially where there's been a jury trial request. China doll burden shifting is fundamentally incompatible with a lawyer-client fee dispute tried to a jury where jurors lack the reasonableness expertise that judges have and exercise in the fee-shifting context. Applying it in a lawyer-client fee dispute improperly relieves the suing lawyer of his or her burden of having to establish true multi-factored ER 1.6 reasonableness as well as
counsel,
having...
Yes. If we agree with you that the court applied the wrong standard, we are nonetheless free to affirm summary judgment for any reason that is supported in the record. So if the record supports that the fees were reasonable under the correct standard, we are still free to affirm. Isn't that accurate?
I would disagree, Your Honor.
Why is that?
This is a unique situation where it was apparent that CDQ was arguing for the wrong standard and the trial judge seemed to be going in that direction. In that situation, my clients had two options. The first was to stand on their objection to the improper burden of proof that was being applied. The second was to go ahead and put on a case with controverting evidence. And had they done the latter, they would have arguably waived any objection to application of the wrong legal standard. There's a case on Arizona on point. It's Phoenix Western Holding Corporation v. LDA Gleason. The site is 18 Arizona Appellate 60. It's a 1972 decision. And it sketches out exactly or very similar circumstance that my clients faced here. They made the choice to stand on their objection to the wrong burden of proof being applied. Had my clients instead decided to go ahead and put on a case under the China doll burden shifting standard that CDQ was arguing for and the trial court had applied, we would have risked waiving this. You will see the analysis in the decision I just cited, and I think it will make sense.
What's the correct standard?
The correct standard is, yes, the correct standard is that it's Carondelet. It's that a lawyer suing to recover his or her fees must establish true multi-factored ER 1.6 reasonableness, not just paste time entries into a spreadsheet. That is not a reasonableness showing. The only reason that works in the fee shifting context is because your honors have reasonableness expertise, which a jury lacks. Okay? Now, in this case, it's not just multi-factored ER 1.6 reasonableness, it's fair value. CDQ wanted the ability to add a kicker onto its fee if things went beautifully. Okay, and so instead of drafting an hourly fee agreement, it drafted a fair value one. It states the fair value standard on the first page, and then in an addendum to it, it explains what fair value is, which is a multi-factored analysis, which includes results obtained, the skill necessary, all that sort of thing. It was the type of thing that if they hit it out of the park, they could arguably put a kicker on the bill because an upcharge would be fair value in a home run context. Well, the inverse applies as well. If things didn't turn out that well, as they didn't while CDQ was on the watch, a discount was arguably appropriate under the fair value standard. CDQ avoided the fair value standard it adopted in its fee agreement like the plague below. It nowhere addressed it, nowhere offered any evidence regarding fair value, which is an essential component of CDQ's burden of proof, which it ignored below.
Do we treat fair value, the fair value issue, the same as we treat the 1.5 issue? In other words, the burden on fair value stays with CDQ? Fair value, it's a breach of contract action. So they say we have an agreement. We had a breach. The clients didn't pay, and we've suffered some damage. I could see an argument that it's then up to your client to come produce documents or evidence or something in response showing a genuine issue of fact on fair value.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. Okay.
I'm not saying that's my position. I'm just
okay.
Testing.
Well, let me outline why I think it's incorrect. The controlling case, which we have cited, is Wells Fargo v. Allen. It was a credit card collection case. CDQ effectively treated this like a credit card collection case from the outset. It took the view that all it had to prove under this sort of contract approach was the fact that there was a fee agreement, the fact that bills were issued, the fact that they were not paid in full. And let me make clear, my clients paid $1.1 million of the $1.3 million. The suggestion that we just walked on the bill is not true. CDQ sued for a relatively small percentage. So in any event, CDQ took the position in its pleadings, in its initial disclosure statement, that this was like a credit card collection case, like Wells Fargo v. Allen, and reasonableness and fair value were irrelevant in that context. They viewed and argued that reasonableness was an affirmative defense that was on us to show unreasonableness, which we strenuously disputed, but the trial judge accepted. Okay? CDQ, as held in Wells Fargo v. Allen, had to make come forward with evidence establishing a prima facie case. In other words, evidence making a showing on each of the elements of its claim. One of the elements of CDQ's breach of contract claim was reasonableness slash fair value. It had to prove both of those as integral elements of its breach of contract claim. Why? Number one, that's the law under Carondelet. Number two, it makes sense. Remember that background applicable law is always an implied term in a contract, regardless of whether there's an incorporation of applicable law provision in the contract. All contracts absorb background applicable law, which included here the obligation for the fees to be reasonable and for the lawyer to carry the burden of proof on reasonableness, not only with respect to the lawyer's collection claim, but as pointed out in the restatement of law governing lawyers, also the burden of showing reasonableness relative to any refund claim brought by the client. The rationale for stated that is stated in Carondelet. Carondelet cites the leading ethics treatise that provides various rationales for this burden of proof allocation. And the restatement of law governing lawyers harmonizes with both Carondelet and this treatise. So to make out a prima facie claim on summary judgment, CDQ not only had to establish the fact of a fee agreement, not only had to establish the fact of the bills, which it left three out of the record below, it had to show that those billings, the time entries, were both reasonable and fair value, which is not just uttering the simplistic, it's reasonable. They had to make a multifactored evidentiary showing of both reasonableness and fair value, which required expert reasonableness testimony, but Albrecht Krogan was never disclosed as an expert. She was listed as a fact witness who would testify to background facts of the representation and the billing history. It was never disclosed until the 11th hour that she would be a reasonable, even at the 11th hour, they didn't list her as a reasonable expert. They just tried to use her as an expert and by supplementing her fact witness description of testimony. So CDQ did not meet its burden of coming forward to make a prima facie case of reasonableness fair value through admissible expert testimony as required. Moreover, and this is just the most basic of shortcomings, three of the four bills are missing in action. CDQ not only took a credit card approach to this case, it took it in a maximal way that it did not even offer all of the bills into evidence. Read Wells Fargo v. Allen. This is very similar to that case.
But didn't your client admit in the answer?
No.
The amounts that were due?
This is, no. Here's what we admitted in the answer. We admitted that there was a fee agreement. We admitted that bills for August, September, October, November had been issued. We admitted the total amounts of those bills. We never admitted and never would have admitted that the specific charges therein were reasonable. This suggestion that our admission of the total amount of the bill was an admission of the bill's reasonableness is wholly unsupported. We never admitted that. Okay, we were simply being upfront about the fact that, yes, they're correct, they issued these bills. Each of the bills was in set amounts. That we admit. We have never admitted that those bills were reasonable and fair value, and CDQ has never presented any admissible evidence of either reasonableness or fair value. And keep in mind that Albrecht Krogan never addressed fair value. And fair value is a distinct type of reasonableness, okay? It's detailed in the fee agreement. It's also addressed in the restatement of law governing lawyers, where the restatement describes it as a measure at the, quote, lower end of reasonableness. Fair value is the standard which courts normally adopt in the quantum Merowit context, okay? And it tends to come in to a lower amount. And we've cited the exact section in our papers. But fundamentally, the point that is made in Wells Fargo v. Allen is that we never get to the question of whether the defendant needed to present or presented controverting evidence if the plaintiff, as a threshold matter, never makes out a prima facie case for failing to come forward in a breach of. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Understanding you to say that that in all cases there must be an expert to make that prima facie case.
I would not go that far. Our position is the position that's taken in St. Ange, which is an early 2000s Connecticut case. If you really want to understand our perspective, please read St. Ange. It really just summarizes it. Here's what St. Ange says. St. Ange says that that in the lawyer-client fee dispute context, we take essentially the same approach that's taken in the legal malpractice context. Okay? In the legal malpractice context, in the medical malpractice context, we have what are called common knowledge cases where expert testimony is not required because a layperson could decide whether, in fact, that was malpractice. Classic examples are leaving a sponge in a patient. You don't need an expert witness to prove that that was malpractice. You don't need an expert witness often to prove that missing the statute of limitations is malpractice because those are common knowledge cases. What St. Ange says is that, look, in that case, as in this case, where the underlying representation was complex, you do normally need an expert, okay? It's possible that in a very simple case, a common knowledge case, you might not. But this, by no stretch of the imagination, is a common knowledge case where jurors could assess the reasonableness of CDQ's billings in a complex commercial litigation matter of this type. Expert reasonableness testimony was required. And notably, CDQ does not appear to dispute that. It uses sort of squishy language. It says both sides needed attorney testimony addressing the reasonableness, appropriateness of these billings. Well, the reason you need expert testimony is because of a lawyer's expertise, okay? That's the definition of expert testimony, what they describe. They say both sides needed it, but they didn't present it, and they lose for that reason. And appellant's cross motion for summary judgment should have been granted below for that very same reason. I want to emphasize the narrow scope of my client's cross motion below. Our cross motion only sought to dismissal of CDQ's claims. It did not seek an award on their refund claim. Okay, so by granting the cross motion based on CDQ lacking admissible expert testimony, that wipes out CDQ's claim, but it is not granting summary judgment on my client's counterclaim, which would proceed to trial. Thank you very much. I'd like to reserve my time.
Good afternoon. I'm used to saying good morning. May it please the court, Al Arpad for Cohen Dow Quigley, the plaintiffs and the appellees in this matter. I'll start with just a couple of notes I made. I'm not sure there's a material difference between reasonableness and fair value. If fair value is a harder standard if it's a lower dollar standard than reasonableness, then that would pretty much nix the idea that that using that standard was a way to get a bonus. I don't think that logic works. But the fact that the fair value standard is clearly laid out in that engagement letter establishes a whole bunch of things. as a matter of fact, not as a matter of expertise. And that really, I think, is where the parties are talking past each other. The case turns on whether you need a lawyer witness to explain the bills, and it can be the lawyer who wrote the bills, or whether you need a designated expert lawyer witness to explain the bills. And I think it's pretty clear that the lawyer can explain their own bills, and it would be a terrible policy error for you to say anything other than that. So once you establish that, the question really comes down to, if you put them under the fact witness category, does that mean you exclude everything they said because everything they said was going to be an opinion? Well, no, it's obviously not. They're percipient witnesses as to when they sent the bills, why they sent the bills, what was in the bills, and it was perfectly reasonable to disclose them as fact witnesses on all of those issues.
Counsel, can you address for me your colleague here's initial argument on the wrong legal standard and the bind that the court addressing this as a China doll case put them in terms of this dichotomy between standing on the objection to the legal standard applied versus making a showing under that wrong standard?
First of all, I think that the difference in the standards has been vastly overstated for the purpose of this case. It is certainly true that trial judges have lots and lots of discretion in deciding a fee application that they don't have in this case. But the trial judge didn't say, I'm going to award you half your fees or the kinds of thing that a trial judge normally, that's just not an issue here. In terms of the bind that the judge put them in, I don't understand that argument at all, because the judge came out with this minute entry long after discovery was closed. So if you've gone back and looked at their disclosure statements and so forth months and months earlier, they've been doing all the arm waving about block billing and so on, but they've got nobody who's going to explain that. They've got literally no witness to say any of the points that they're trying to make. And so we didn't put them in that bind. The trial judge didn't put them in that bind. They got to that point through a deliberate strategy of saying, we're going to try and poke holes in the plaintiff's disclosure and say they have 100% of the burden. And then it turns out there's all this fact evidence that's sufficient to meet the burden. And so the theory doesn't work, and so they've got nothing. And so the trial judge granted summary judgment. And that's, if you fail to raise an issue of fact at summary judgment as the non-moving party, you lose. The Allen case is one that I've cited in lots of cases where I had some tough sledding after summary judgment has been granted against me. One of the differences you pointed out, Judge Catlett, is that I don't think the Allens had admitted the amounts of the bills ahead of time. So you've got a very basic leg up on them for that. As an appellate attorney, there's always something I wish was in the record. I wish we had complete invoices in the record. But again, when you start with the admissions of how much the fees were, and you've got the substantive evidence that you've got available in this case, and then they come back with nothing, that's summary judgment material. Did that answer your question, Judge Perkins, about the bind that mm-hmm. they were put in? I just don't see it.
But I would appreciate if you would next talk to me. I understand you to be saying it doesn't matter. The fair value versus reasonableness doesn't matter.
I'm not sure I see a material difference. I mean, you can, any normal person reading that engagement letter would say, my attorney has promised to go through here and make sure my bills are fair value. And I do not think we lose the case because our bills were fair value instead of reasonable. So I don't think there's a material difference. Now, there may be some deep difference in terms of what it said on page 2 and 3 about what the factors are, but there's lots of evidence that qualified lawyers who did the work went through and looked at these bills, took some write-downs, sent them off to the clients. They're going to be able to testify at trial. Maybe they will be prevented from giving an expert's, because they weren't under the expert heading in the disclosure statement. So maybe they will be prevented from giving a retrospective opinion, yes, I have now looked at everything again, and I think they are reasonable. Maybe they will be prevented from answering hypothetical questions. Maybe there are other things that they won't be able to, there may be other limits on their testimony because they weren't designated as experts. But they're going to be able to say, I'm the one who prepared these bills. I looked at them at the time because my contract required me to bill for fair value, and I thought they were fair value, and I did that. Did you think you met your contractual standard, counsel? Yes, I think I did. I certainly tried to. That's all evidence.
I mean, I think the crux of this case, or the first question we have to ask is, did your client come for, because your client has the burden of persuasion at trial. It's a plaintiff. Mm-hmm. So on summary judgment, I think the case law says a client in your position that's moving for summary judgment has a burden of production, has to come forward with evidence, and has to come forward with evidence from which a jury could find that the defendants breached the contract. If your client does that, the burden shifts. It's not an evidentiary burden. It's not, the burden of persuasion doesn't shift. But the defendants then have to come forward with their own evidence showing not that your fees were unreasonable, which I think is what the trial court did here, but that there's a question of fact as to reasonableness. Right?
I think those are all fair statements. I'm not hearing anything there that I disagree with.
Right. I guess without the invoices in the record, how did your client satisfy the burden of production with respect to those specific fees in this case?
Because the total amounts had already been admitted, and there's lots of other evidence that the other ones had been sent to them and were in their possession and were included in subsequent proceedings.
Do you agree that part of your burden of production and persuasion in a attorney's fees case is reasonableness?
There are, I don't think that's been decided in Arizona, and there's some case law, including the St. Ange case, talking about the difference between implied and express contracts. And so there's some authority out there that if we have a burden, it's a very low burden. But knowing the Arizona Supreme Court, I suspect that they're going to put some burden on us. Yes.
Okay. The total amounts don't tell us if the fees reflected in those amounts are reasonable. So without the invoices showing what was done to justify those amounts, how does your client meet its burden of production or persuasion?
Again, the totals were not there, and there were voluminous documents there that showed the type of stuff that had been done. So, for instance, there is 1 month out of the 4 months of bills. There's 1 month that's in there in both versions. It's in there in the version that was submitted to the in the spreadsheet version that was submitted to the court or to the arbitrator, and it's also in there as a bill. And if you compare those, you can see the types of things that were taken out. For instance, I think there's an entry about they called me about personnel issues today. Well, I didn't have anything to do with the arbitration, so that's why that was taken out. And our witness would be able to testify to that and did, in fact, submit a declaration saying in some at some length that the bills were reasonable and so on and so forth, and here's how much this one was, and I sent it, and here's how much I took off, and so on and so forth. I think that at least is the prima facie showing that we were required to make. If they want to come back and pick holes in it, then maybe we needed to present more than that. But I do think that makes the prima facie showing.
Let's say, and I'm not saying this is true or not, let's say at trial your client would have to convince the jury both that the fees were reasonable and that they were fair value. What evidence did your client submit at summary judgment to satisfy its burden of production and persuasion on fair value versus reasonableness? Assuming I think they're two different things. Because I've read Ms. Albrecht's declaration, and there's nothing in there about fair value.
But the engagement letter says fair value.
Right.
And I think she's testifying that she went through them all and tried to send them out as she was supposed to under the contract. She's certainly going to testify to that. I guess I would have to know what you think the real difference is before I could say what different evidence would prove either of those standards. I'm not sure there is a material difference, and certainly not under the facts of this case.
I think the restatement seems to think there's a difference.
When you get deep, I think we met under the facts of this case, I think we met both. Our position certainly is that we met both, and that the witness was more than qualified to testify that we met both and would have testified that we met both, and that that's pretty clearly laid out in the summary judgment motion, and that if somebody disagrees with that, it's up to them to come back and say some reason why that isn't the case, or in fact produce an expert.
Because most of her declaration is about interactions she had with the client in terms of the declaration that was filed in this case,
yeah,
is about her interaction with the clients in terms of cutting, giving discounts and things like trying to get them to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think she incorporates by reference the declaration that was filed in the arbitration, mm-hmm, right?
I believe that's true.
The purpose of the declaration in the arbitration was to, I think, solely focused on reasonableness of her fees. Was fair value at issue at all in the arbitration?
Not motion? That I'm aware of.
Okay.
Again, that is a fee award.
Yeah.
But I am still not seeing in the context of this case.
I understand you're saying she would testify about fair value, but on summary judgment, she has to do it in a declaration, right?
I think we're getting dangerously close to a magic words type situation there. If she gave substantive testimony and the documentary records show that they were doing their best to bill fair value, that's evidence of billing at fair value, even if she doesn't use the magic words in her declaration. I do believe counsel admitted that my client could testify about billing history. And as I've said, I think that gets right into then, yeah, I billed in accordance with the contract which says fair value. I mean, I think we're there. And there just is, this is not a case where you've got, St. Ange was a case where, again, they were distinguishing between an express, the jury, it was after a jury trial. So if I'm remembering correctly, the jury found that they only had an implied contract, not an express contract. And the court said, well, it might be different if it was an express contract, but for an implied contract, you had to show that you charged a reasonable fee, and maybe fair value would have been the correct thing because they're using quantum merit. But either way, what the court then said was, the witnesses who got up were the lawyers who did the work. And the court didn't say they couldn't have testified to that. They just didn't. And so the judge granted a directed verdict, and I believe the appellate court upheld it. That's a different situation from what we've got here. And it recognizes, I think, a lot of the points that I'm making is that this is not at all a case, which the defendants have said over and over again, where our entire case had to be thrown out because we didn't designate an expert. There's tons of facts, testimony that's enough to be dispositive. As Judge Perkins had said earlier, if there's sufficient evidence, even if the judge put in one too many China doll quotes in there, it's pretty clear the judge said we had to make a detailed showing first. And the evidence is there.
How can Ms. Albrecht Krogan testify that the hourly rates charged are reasonable when compared to the hourly rates charged by other attorneys and paralegals in the Phoenix area without being an expert?
I think she can testify that we looked at that when we set our rates. Anything like that, there could be a lot of, if we're going to go to trial on the view that nobody's allowed to give expert testimony because nobody designated an expert, we're going to be probably spending a lot of time conferencing with the judge about, okay, you've got to phrase it a certain way, it can't be a hypothetical, it can't be a retrospective opinion, it's got to be, we sat down and did that when we set the rates. Okay. That's enough to get past summary judgment if the other side's got zero. I think that's everything I have. If you'll let me look just briefly.
Isn't there case law that says, and again, this is back in the China Doll area, but isn't there case law that says a reasonable rate is the rate that's agreed to between the attorney and the client in an arm's length transaction?
China Doll does talk about that. I doubt, again, that the Arizona, I had a partners back in my day when I was with the firm who wanted to argue a very hard version of that, and I don't know that that's going to be successful very often. But yes, I think that's a component. When you've got an express contract and it says, here's what we're doing, and you say, yeah, and I looked it over and I wrote some stuff off as duplicative and I sent out the bill, you're pretty darn close at that point to meeting your burden. And then
that doesn't mean that the amount, the total amount billed is reasonable. It just means one part of the equation, the hourly rate, maybe is reasonable.
I think it's getting to most of those things. I mean, you've got testimony, not just that I looked it over and made sure I thought it was fair value and sent it out. You've then got, and then we debated about it and sent emails back and forth about it, and we gave you some more discounts, and then we submitted it to an arbitrator who found it was reasonable and awarded it. I mean, we may not be using the magic word fair value, but it sure seems like evidence of fair value that a jury could decide the case on.
Counsel, quick question. I just want to make sure. So it's your position that your firm or your client just needed to make a prima facie showing that the fees were reasonable?
I am not 100% sure that prima facie is applied consistently across all contexts where it's used. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not. But yes, they needed to just make a showing that this was reasonable, that would be sufficient for a jury to find in their favor. I think that's essentially what Judge Cattler recited, and I agree with that. Maybe there are situations where prima facie means something different than that, but I don't think using that word in that context is an error that you can overturn for.
Well, I think your argument is that is sufficient for purposes of shifting the burden of production on summary judgment to the
Yes,
defendants.
Yes, and if you look at the whole record here, I think it's in the response to the to their cross motion for summary judgment, we included some of their disclosure statements. And it's very much the same thing that it was throughout the case. It's just kind of arm waving, block billing, terrible results. No witness listed who could remotely give that testimony. Nothing. Summary judgment in this context just isn't surprising. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks. Rebuttal.
Your Honors, I would like to go over with you precisely what I encountered below. This is CDQ's initial disclosure statement. This is CDQ's first supplemental disclosure statement served 4 days before the discovery cutoff. Okay? CDQ's initial disclosure statement said the following for Ms. Albrecht-Krogan. Ms. Albrecht-Krogan is a partner at CDQ and is expected to testify about the facts and legal theories described herein. Note at the outset that that's inconsistent with the obligation under 26.1 to describe the substance of someone's testimony as opposed to the subject area. But that's all it said. Facts and law above. Well, okay, let's accept that cross-reference. What's above? Nothing. The factual background above is a recounting of the billing history, very similar, although not anywhere near as detailed, because the emails that Ms. Albrecht quoted in her summary judgment declaration were dumped on us on the last day of disclosure, the very deadline, which then she incorporates in block quotes throughout her declaration. But in the initial disclosure statement,
under the current version of the rules, if you thought that in the initial disclosure statement was insufficient, wasn't it incumbent on you to tee up a motion to compel?
No. Our opposing counsel made it clear that
He viewed this as a credit card case. All they had to do was put in the agreement, state the amounts of the bills, and show that we didn't pay them. That's the reason they didn't list an expert. It's why they said they didn't anticipate getting an expert, because they had this minimalist view of their burden. And I welcomed them taking that approach. It's a horrible approach. Okay, if they want to go without an expert, I'm not going to go force them to get one. Okay? It's not my job to convince them to take a different approach in their case. They said, we don't need an expert. They didn't list an expert in here. They didn't list an area. But then, towards the end, they get nervous about their credit card approach. And so what do we get? We get the first supplemental disclosure statement on January 13, 2025, where there's just a dump. We go from one sentence for Albrecht Krogan to three pages. Okay? Note that even then, this expanded three-page summary of her anticipated testimony still nowhere uses the word reasonable, nowhere mentions fair value. None of those terms appear. Then what do we get?
Counsel, you're out of time.
My apologies. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you for your helpful briefing in the case and your oral argument this afternoon. We will take the matter under advisement and get you a ruling in due course.